Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Major General Walter Piatt. General Piatt is the commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division based at Fort Drum. The general assumed command of the unit last year and served in the division at previous points in his career. He's had deployments and assignments around the world and at the Pentagon and has extensive experience in Afghanistan and Iraq. General Piatt, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, first things first, we want to thank you for your service. And I think everybody in our listening area at least knows of Fort Drum and the 10th Mountain Division. But I think it would help if you could give our listeners a brief overview of the division's recent history and the extensiveness of its deployments in the Middle East, maybe since 9/11. I don't know if you go back that far, but yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we have a very rich history. We were created really in World War II and in Colorado, we were the first Americans Alpine troops and the first Mountain Division and saw extensive combat in World War II. And then it went to a training mission, and then they were inactivated. And then in the middle of the 1980s, in 1985, the Army expanded and brought back one division, and it was lobbied for. We named it the 10th Mountain Division. At that time, we wore the mountain tab to honor our past. But we're not a specialized unit anymore. We have to be able to fight in all different terrains and all different environments. But we carry that strong history to us. But since 9/11, the division has been the most deployed division in the United States Army. I was at Fort Drum on 9/11. We were the first division to deploy to Afghanistan, conventional unit deployed to Afghanistan. And since then, we've had units deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan almost constantly. Currently, we have 4,000 soldiers deployed all over the world, to include a brigade in Iraq, a battalion in Afghanistan. We have an Apache battalion, or one of our helicopter battalions, in Korea. And we have soldiers stationed throughout Africa as well. So we like to say the sun never sets on the 10th Mountain Patch, and that is true, and especially since 9/11.
And when I was reading a bit about the division's history, and you mentioned this going back to its origins as not only a mountain unit, but I guess a sort of a winter combat unit. And there's an irony there, given your deployments in recent decades.
There is. And we're proud of that history. And we actually brought it back. We're designated an Army Arctic unit. So we specialize in cold weather training. We have the Army's latest cold weather kit. We just had a winter symposium at Fort Drum, and we share that with U.S. Army Alaska and our National Guard brothers from Camp Jericho in Vermont at Camp Ethan Allen. So we're bringing that back. We have to be able to do it and to fight in those altitudes, as many we've seen in Afghanistan. We were at 11, 12,000 feet in some of our operations. But every unit has to be able to do that. We just want to be prepared.
Well, as you mentioned, the division has a long history of involvement in Afghanistan, and you've written a couple books about your experiences in that country. It seems to me that nation is getting less mainstream media attention in recent years relative to Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And so I wanted to get, before we get into what's going to happen with the Mountain Division soon here, I wanted to get your take on Afghanistan, though, first. Where is that country right now? What would you say its prospects are for a reasonably stable democracy? And what do you think America's proper role is there going forward? Give me your sense of that country.
Yeah, that's a very good question, very deep question. And I would just speak from my experiences that the Afghan people deserve a right to be a sovereign nation and a chance for real and lasting peace. They are a resilient people and a very kind people. And very resourceful people. In many areas where I served in Paktika province especially, they were able to farm in very remote places without a lot of resources, have many nomadic tribes that live in that area. They are peaceful people. I think people don't know a lot about Afghanistan. They're quick to judge. Unfortunately, it's still a very, very difficult place because the country is fighting, a very serious internal threat, very serious Islamic State threat as well in Afghanistan. So they need our help. They need the help of the international nations as well to come there for the Afghan people. Mm-hmm. I know it's difficult because it's been a long war. People want to know, is it winnable? Is there an end in sight in Afghanistan? But you got to remember, this is a sovereign nation, and they deserve it. Their army has been built, and they've been doing extremely well. But the threat from within and the threat from the Taliban is very serious. And I think that there must be real political solutions before the country would move forward to a lasting peace. But I'm hopeful because I have many friends that are Afghans, and I hope that they get the peace that they deserve.
And if I could get a little bit more from you on your sense of what the United States' role should be, and particularly in terms of the military, of course. But you know, that's a constant source of discussion and concern in this country as to what is the level of our involvement, how many troops would we have over there, and so on. How do you see that going, or how should it be going in the future?
Well, I think our support is security assistance, and I think our 10th Mountain Division has been very active in helping our Army develop security force assistant brigades, and it's one of the chief staff of the Army, General Milley's chief initiatives is to build these type of brigades that focus less on combat enablers and be able to execute combat, but they can go and advise, enable, and accompany forces while fighting internal security threats in their nation. So I think the military's role will be to continue to support and advise, because for these political solutions to take place, when they do, the foundation needs to be security, followed by rule of law, and the security forces, not just the Army, not just the Afghan Army, but the police and federal police will have to establish enough security on the ground so that they can move forward. So I think the U.S. is committed to helping our Afghan brothers and partners there to get over and rid this country from this internal threat and move forward to better days.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with General Walter Piatt, commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum. The 10th Mountain Division is getting ready for a deployment back to Iraq, this time in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. And you've recently returned from a pre-deployment trip to that country. Tell me a little bit about what you encountered there.
Yeah, we were just there the first couple of weeks in January, and it's been a while since I've been there. And what we encountered was really a very optimistic Iraqi people. We were able to fly over Baghdad several times. We were able to see Baghdad from the embassy, from where our headquarters will be. We got to work with different operations centers and security forces inside Baghdad. The city looks normal. I mean, there's a lot of life. There's water parks and Ferris wheels. The power was on. Lights were on all night long. Normal city traffic jams with everyone obeying the traffic laws. It looked like a congested city. And then when we went up to Mosul, you could see the destruction of Western Mosul. I mean, it was a terrible fight with ISIS, who occupied that territory, attempted to establish the caliphate. And, of course, they were defeated there militarily. They were defeated as a military arm. So you still see the destructions of the current fight against ISIS, but you see a real hope in the Iraqi people, which I thought was just really, really special to see after my many previous deployments in Iraq.
So tell me a little bit about now the nature of your unit's new mission. Where will it be specifically in the country? What's it going to be doing? What's it going to be trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, we'll be in most parts of the country. So we'll be from Mosul to Kirkuk to western Anbar inside Baghdad itself. So wherever the Iraqi security forces are established, what they've worked for and what our mission simply will be to be advise and assist and enable the Iraqi security forces and also to train them. So we'll have one mission to help integrate the security forces as they provide post-conflict security so that stabilization and reconstruction can begin to grow. But we'll also be training them in many of the training bases around the country, and not just the Army. We're going to get back into training Army brigades, but we're going to be training federal police forces and especially border guard forces, which are really needed now. And those forces, we just never had the time because of the ISIS threat to complete our training mission there. Now, it's part of a coalition. You know, our soldiers are deploying. This week, we'll start to send folks over, and by the end of month, early March, I'll be there, and by mid-March, we'll assume the duties as a coalition joint force land component command of a coalition of 74 members. So it's not just the U.S. So we're there to support, but we will work for the Iraqi security forces and for the Iraqi people. We're not in charge anymore. The Iraqi security forces are in charge, but we will give them the help they need when they ask for it.
I've always wondered, in the nature of this role that you've been describing, of one of providing security assistance and training, and you're there to advise and instruct, whether that puts your units and the personnel in kind of a tough position sometimes, because I would think that you might have a better sense of how to go about doing something, or better sense of seeing what strategy is going to produce what. But you're not calling the shots, in a sense, as you just pointed out. You're not, you know, you're not in charge. So how do you navigate that? I've always thought that would be a tough spot for a U.S. soldier to be in.
Well, I think most of the time, I tell our soldiers when we deploy, we have a packing list. You must take exactly the right thing. You imagine it's the Army. You have to stay within a standard. But I also tell them, don't bring American arrogance with you. Leave arrogance at home. And it's a key ingredient, because the Iraqi people, they know how to organize and conduct security operations. It's their country. They know it extremely well. They know their people really well. It's like me trying to advise a New York street policeman how to police his beat. I mean, he or she, they walk that beat every day. They know the people, they know the terrain, they know the land. But what we can do is help them with things that they maybe haven't had a lot of practice doing, and that's integrating enablers real time, bringing, like with the fight against ISIS, bringing in air assets, artillery assets, fusing intelligence so they could better target. And they really appreciate that, because it's some things they may not have a lot of time doing, and that helps them to get their mission complete. But they are in charge, and I always tell folks, you have to listen, because they have a better way of doing it. When we know what they want to do, we can better support them in how they get it done.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Major General Walter Pyatt, commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, and we're discussing the division's upcoming deployment into Iraq in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. Does your mission, General, have a specified end date? Do you know already when your troops are going to be coming back to Fort Drum?
Normally, we do. The divisions now are on a 9-month rotation. We used to previously do 12 months. On this rotation, though, some of that will be what we call conditions-based. So some soldiers may begin redeployment as their mission reaches a maturity. So we're kind of we're hopeful for that. Or some of them will leave Iraq and move down to Kuwait. So this one, we're pretty sure that it'll be about 9 months. That's what our deployment cycle is. But where we do it and where we stay, we're not wed to the plan per se. We're wed to how we can enable the Iraqi people and the Iraqi security forces.
And that leads directly to something else I wanted to explore with you, which is that, you know, our country's involvement in this region has been so long term. It's had its ups, it's had its downs. How are you going to measure success here in this present mission? How do you know whether, you know, the objective has been achieved or not?
Well, I think it's important for everyone to know the success that the Iraqi people have had against the Islamic State, because the Islamic State was not just a threat to Iraq, and it was not just a threat to the region. It's a threat to the world. And what the Iraqi security forces did, they did for the world. They took them on. The Islamic State was really at the gates of Baghdad, almost had the nation overthrown. And it was Iraqi security forces who literally were pushed back initially, but it was Iraqi people themselves that mobilized and pushed this threat back and continued to pursue it throughout Anbar and all the way up the Tigris River Valley and all the way to Mosul, where the fight was really, really tough. And it was the Iraqi security forces, although they were enabled by the coalition. We did bring in high-tech aircraft. We did bring in artillery fires. But it was them who went door-to-door and street-to-street and block-by-block. And they suffered for it. I mean, over 1,600 casualties, I mean, killed in action from the Iraqi army. They don't have the great medical care that the United States military has. They died, but they did not waver. They kept moving forward. And I think we need to know, I know our presence in the region is controversial, but you can't take away what the Iraqi security forces did and the Iraqi people did to defeat the Islamic State. Now, they're not destroyed. That destruction must be completed. So we'll be able to complete it when we see the Iraqi people say, our nation's secure enough. We just need your help. We need your enablers. That will be how we know the mission is successful.
And so you'll be looking to do your part in that in certain areas in which you're deployed. That's going to be your kind of your standard then of whether the objective has been achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's tough. As tough as that fight was against Islamic State in Mosul, and as I said, Western Mosul's just completely in ruins. But now the people are coming back. So this is even a critical time right now, because without stabilization, without a place to live, you know, the good feeling of living and surviving this terrible conflict is one thing. But you really want to get running water in your house. You want to get back to work. You want your kids to go back to school. You want normal signs of life to start to bring up. That's what I think we'll see the signs. And once that starts to happen, and the military is able to move outside the cities, and police are in charge for internal security in the cities, this is a normal transition. But as I remind soldiers and people all the time, wars don't end in peace. Peace is a different struggle altogether, and helping build that peace requires security forces. Now, we're not the main effort. The Iraqi security forces aren't the main effort, but you need the government and reconstruction, but it's longer and it's harder to do, but you need security forces to provide that support while they're doing it.
I'll turn the focus around now to here. The deployments of the division obviously have a great impact on the local community that comprises and surrounds Fort Drum. Tell me a little bit about, in your experience, how are deployments experienced by the community?
Well, I've been stationed all over the world, and it's my third time being assigned to Fort Drum in the 10th Mountain Division. It is the best military community in our Army. It is by far the best. When we expanded the base in the middle of the 80s, we deliberately didn't build a hospital on the base. We didn't build schools on the base. It forced us to connect with the community in multiple areas. So our children attend many schools, but three really large public schools that they attend. We use five different local hospitals to provide our readiness that we need for our soldiers. So we're connected. So the community is invested. They understand the difficulties of these deployments. But soldiers sacrifice for their nation, but they'll do many things. But when they know that their family has a good place to live and their kids are in good schools and they're living in communities that really appreciate military service and they have access to health care, soldiers will go and deploy over and over again because they know their families are being taken care of. And the North Country community, best there is.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division based at Fort Drum, General Walter Piatt. Now, General, I know and understand that you need to steer away from politics. But there's a question related to politics that I just simply have to ask you. And it's this. I think it's fair to say that President Trump, whether or not one supports his policy proposals, has engaged in a different kind and a more freewheeling kind of rhetoric when it comes to international relations and potential international conflicts. Now, I know you're a strategic thinker. You've written books and you've engaged in that aspect of things. How does that approach strike you strategically?
Well, I never get asked by our National Security Advisor, but National Security Advisor right now is a Lieutenant General, H.R. McMaster. Obviously, we have to understand the strategy because we're asked to execute the operational and tactical level of war. This is a troubled region. And so our job as a military is to do what our national leaders ask us to do. We must provide them options. There's no clear end state. I think I've seen this strategically, that the military is going to be given a set of instructions. If you do this, this, and this, everything will work out. It's a very complicated mess. And we must provide those options for our national leadership so they can help keep our nation secure and help protect our interests around the world. They don't explain those kind of details to us at our level, but we understand that when forces are committed to a theater, it's to protect, you know, the vital interests of this nation and to assure our allies and to deter our adversaries. And we know we're a tool that has to be utilized. That's why we're ready. We also maintain a high level of combat readiness so that we can prevent future wars. It's what our military does. So I always tell people, I go where I'm told. And they tell the 10th Mountain Division to go somewhere, you can be guaranteed one thing. We go where we're told, we fight where we go, and we win where we fight.
So you've had a long career in the Army, but I'm always interested in knowing a bit about how people get into their lines of work in the first place. And so I wanted to take a little bit of time here in the last part of our interview to talk about that. You joined the Army in 1979, and you served as an enlisted soldier for 4 years. So let me start with this. What prompted you originally to decide to join the Army?
Well, I always wanted to serve. My father served in World War II. He worked in a steel mill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I can hear that in your voice. It sounds familiar. My grandfather lived in Aliquippa. That's where my father was from.
It slips in every now and then. But he always told me it's honorable to serve. And that inspired me. And I thought if I enlisted, I'd do one term. I got out and went to college, and I was inspired again to serve. And I was only going to do a few years and then get out and go to graduate school and pursue another career. That obviously didn't happen, but I was just come from a long family that, you know, had served. I'm the only one that's made a long career out of it in my family, but I've always wanted to and admired those people that served. And as a little kid, you go to Memorial Day parades and Veterans Day parades, and you see the veterans and how proud they are. I just wanted to make sure that I did my part for my country like every other citizen wants to do.
So the other part of that, though, that you alluded to, what made you decide to make the career out of this? That is something I'm curious to hear about.
Well, I was intending to get out at one point, and you know, it just kind of happened. just kind of stayed in. I've always loved it, and at many times I was close to maybe getting out and pursuing other things, and I would just say, you know, I really like it. I really like the people. I like our mission. It's tough. It's a tough life, but the rewards are so great because you get to serve with so many different people, and you get to move so often that you're never, you never feel like you're stuck somewhere. The challenges are constantly changing, so it's a great environment. We push and honor and really value education in the military, which is something I really like because I wanted to pursue higher education, and I was able to pursue, you know, advanced degrees really on the Army's time and on the Army's dime, and it was really helpful to me. I didn't have to sacrifice in order to do that. It actually enabled my career.
Now, not many officers write books about their experience, and you've done that a few times now. So tell me a bit about that process. What is driving you to want to share that, and frankly, how do you carve out the time to do it?
Yeah, my first one was really a book of poems and letters that I wrote for my wife after 9/11 deploying to Afghanistan. And to be honest, it's very therapeutic for me. I think that we have to find ways to deal with our stress. And for me, writing was that, and thinking about these moments and writing them down and talking about them helped me understand it and process it. And I think sharing it with other soldiers, I get that because they'll read short stories or things that I've written. And they may have a different take, or they may have a different conclusion, but they both admit that, you know, it was just good to read that. It was just good to feel it. So for me, it's been very therapeutic and helpful. And I do believe there's a side of the war that just doesn't get told. I think what soldiers do every day on their mission doesn't get told that much. And I also believe, in my experience in Afghanistan, what the Afghan people do does not get told a lot. And I've had a very good friend who was the governor of Paktika province when I was there. And when we were done with our mission in a very successful year in a very dangerous place, and we were able to bring elections there, and we were able to bring a lot of goodness to an area that only had known hatred and violence, at the end of the year, I asked him, you know, Governor Mangal, I said, sir, you know, why did it work so well between you and I? How, you know, what can I learn from this? And he said, Walt, it was you. He said, you became my friend first before you told me what to do. And I just really thought about that. And really what he was saying is, you know, seek first to understand before you demand to be understood. And in the Army, we're pretty much a hammer sometimes. But to understand that these are real people in sovereign countries going through some very difficult times that we can help. It's not all about violence. When we need to do that, we do it with surgical precision for limited time for a specific reason. But it's the people that are still there, and you can bring hope by just getting to know them and understand what they're struggling with before you try to apply a security solution to their world, their nation.
I wanted to draw on your interest in writing and obviously reading to ask you to tell me and our listeners, other than the works of General Piatt, where would you send folks who want to get a sense of what things are really like or were really like at various places in the Middle East. Among the books that are out there, either fiction or memoir, nonfiction, are there some where you've read where you said that person kind of nailed it there?
Yeah, that's a great question. My wife thinks I have a real problem with Amazon, so I got to be careful before recommending books. I'd say, you know, for me, it's always the next one, you know, get the next book. I always advise, we don't have like a commander's reading list. We have mm-hmm. a group list because we don't want everyone to read the same thing. We want to all read something different and come at it from different angles. And I think it's really good. My first rule is read something written by someone from the country, first of all.
Oh.
And be careful because historic views are really good. Political debate is always very good. But if you're going to go to Afghanistan or Iraq, it's very good to read something from there. On a previous deployment to Iraq, I had our brigade. I recommended that we read The Poet of Baghdad, but a young man who grows up and wants to be a poet in the Saddam years. But it talks about the struggle of being an Iraqi family and the role of the mother in the family and how solid the bond was and how scared they were from policemen coming at night. So it gave us an insight to what we would see and understanding it from the other person's perspective. Which often we don't get in our military planning because it's just us. We don't get to bring in those other perspectives. I'm reading a book right now called The Corpse Washer, and it's a very good book about a young man who grows up in Iraq. His father washes corpse in Baghdad, and he wants to be an artist. And so I'm not quite finished with it yet, but it's a neat story that tells you that puts the human side to these people that happen to live in Iraq. And I think it's just I encourage people to do so. A Day of Honey is another good one that I remember reading about an American journalist who goes over there and understands people through just their food and the ritual and culture that surrounds food. And there are many. I have many lists on Afghanistan and Iraq for folks to read. But I encourage everyone, just read something from the country and written from someone that's from there first.
Great suggestions. Thanks. That was General Walter Piatt. General, safe travels to you and your men and women. And again, thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you. Climb to glory.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.